I'm Leslie Weidenbender. Today on No Limits, we're talking about hunger, food pantries, and possible cuts in the federal SNAP program, which is better known as food stamps. Estimates find that more than 80,000 children in the Indianapolis area are at risk for hunger, and according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, more than 16 million American children are at risk of hunger across the nation. Today, we'll talk about the issue with Cindy Hubert, the president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Dave Miner, with the Indy Hunger Network, and Clark Linneman, the executive director of the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, managing editor of the StateHouseFile.com, a news website powered by Franklin College journalism students. I'm sitting in today for John Kroll. We'll be talking about hunger, summer food programs, and food banks. And in the studio today, we have Cindy Hubert, the president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank. Welcome to the show, Cindy.
Thank you very much, Leslie.
We also have Dave Miner, executive director of the Indy Hunger Network. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks for having us.
And finally, we have Clark Linneman, the executive director of the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center, which operates an emergency food pantry and provides meals to kids and seniors on the west side of Indianapolis. Welcome to the show, Clark.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You can call us at 866-476-3881, email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Clark, I'd like to start with you if we could. You're right there in the neighborhoods dealing with people every day. Tell us a little bit about the center and what kinds of services you provide.
Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center is in its 101st year of service for Indianapolis and the inner city area. And we provide a wide range of services for youth, young adults, working age adults, older adults, and families who are challenged by very low income in the inner city neighborhoods that we serve. And food is one of many important elements in that work.
And I know that all of you work together and have some partnerships. Cindy, your organization runs a food bank. Can you tell us what a food bank is and how that's different from a food pantry?
Sure. The food bank itself is what you would call the wholesaler. We gather all the food from a number of sources, both the retail as well as food donations, and then we provide it through 350 agencies, pantries, if you will, throughout the city, including Mary Rigg. Our job is to gather it all in and then make sure it's distributed out through the community.
Cindy, how much food are we talking about that runs through your organization?
Well, last year it was 25 million pounds, which is about 20 million meals on an annual basis. Up last year was 20%, and we're running about 22% ahead of last year.
And where does most of that food come from?
It comes from three different sources. We get it, as I said, from our retail partners, which are the Kroger's, the Marsh, the Walmart's, the Meijer's. We also distribute the USDA commodities for the state and the federal government, as well as we get it through food drives. So those are three different ways. And Clark and I were speaking earlier that the first time in our history of over 33 years, in the last year and a half, we've begun to purchase food to ensure that we have the right nutritional food in the system. So that is a new part and component to what we do at Gleaners.
And Dave, can you tell us a little bit about the Indy Hunger Network, how it works, and who are the partners there?
Sure. And I'm honored to do this with Cindy at my side because Cindy, going back a few years, recognized that this was a very complex matrix of people that were responding to hunger, providing food assistance. And so Cindy called a group together, and that group turned into the Indy Hunger Network. The Indy Hunger Network is all the big food assistance providers collaborating together. So it's Gleaners Food Bank, it's Midwest Food Bank, Second Helpings, SECOA, Meals on Wheels, and then representatives of the federal programs as well, so SNAP and WIC and school meals. And the premise was if it's as complex as it is, and Clark is runs one of many pantries, over 200 pantries in the city, prior to Cindy's initiative, this people didn't know each other. They didn't work together. You can't have a system that's going to work effectively with that many players and without the people working together. So that's what the Indy Hunger Network has set out to do, is work together to fill in the gaps, to make sure that all the pieces are working together well. Everybody has an important piece, but they need to work together well, or we don't have a prayer of meeting all the need.
And do you feel like that's working well? I mean, have you been able to eliminate some overlap and fill in some of those gaps?
Yes. I would say remarkably well. It's a real testament to the leaders of those seven organizations that I mentioned, that they've been willing to come together and collaborate, because they all have their own important organization to run and to raise money for, but they've been willing to work together. And yes, we've seen, we think, some dramatic results, mostly not duplication, a little bit of opportunities for efficiency. If somebody had too much of something, they provided it to somebody else who needed it. But more, it's been about the gaps, places that nobody was really covering or that wasn't being covered well.
You know, the government provides some food assistance through the food stamp, through the SNAP program, through school lunches, and then you all represent several nonprofit organizations. It seems like there are a tremendous number of food services available to people. Why are there gaps, and why are there still needs? Clark?
Well, we have a large population that we're all trying to collectively serve and efficiently serve. Even in the school-based programs, you have children, students that are showing up hungry, and schools are trying to provide breakfast, lunch, and then after school or other community-based organizations are providing dinners. When school's out, all that dynamic changes. So we see a huge spike up coming to our food pantry or coming to the neighborhood center for help when school's out, whether that's in intersession breaks or over a long summer. Food is a huge need for families, and collectively we're all trying to meet that need.
As Clark said, there's no difference if the families who are struggling to put food on the table, their situation is no better in the summertime than it is during the school year. And so if the kids are suddenly missing, you know, five lunches a week or five lunches and five breakfasts a week, that's a huge impact on the families in the summertime.
So the need spikes up in the summer. Do you have enough food to provide those services?
Yes. There's never quite enough. It's going up all the time. But, you know, as funny as I thought this about this conversation, we had record-breaking numbers of families that participated. We have a pantry associated with Gleaners. And last Thursday, we had 390 families. That represents anywhere between 1,200 and 1,500 people. That was a record-breaking day for us. So as Dave said, and Clark, the summer doesn't make the problem go away. So we have to gear up to make sure that the families and the children are fed, for sure.
So if I can give you an example of collaboration, when the Indy Hunger Network got involved, we learned about the Summer Meals Program, which is a federal program, runs through the state, through the Department of Education. And we looked at it because there's only about one-sixth as many meals served in the summertime as there are free and reduced lunches during the year. And so you're like, no, wait a minute, you know, why is this one-sixth? So we looked at it and we found out there was lots of sites, and then we looked at where they were located, you know, and location wasn't too bad, higher number of sites in the high need areas, but no marketing and publicity. Mm-hmm. So what the Hunger Network is doing is sort of supporting the people running the programs at the grassroots level, like Mary Rigg, supporting Gleaners, who's doing this outside of Indianapolis, but putting in the promotion piece, which nobody had the setup for or the budget for.
I have to say, I've heard much more about the summer food program this year than I can remember hearing about. Have you found that that's making a difference? Clark, have you found that's making a difference at your location?
Somewhat. Going back to your other question, though, there still remains gaps, even with the greater awareness. And I think that one of the gaps that we see existing is there still is an opportunity to improve broad community awareness of the food and hunger problem in our central Indiana area. We need our community to confront the reality. It's not just numbers. When you see a headline of one out of every four children are hungry, that probably means one out of every three families is facing hunger or hunger-related issues, and we need a broader community acceptance of that. It's tough. It's tough to accept that, in America or in our own community and backyard. It may not be down your street or your neighbor, but within our broad community of Central Indiana and Indianapolis, it's a big number of families that struggle with food each and every day, and it can't be taken out of context with the other things that they're struggling with, whether it's unemployment or lack of health insurance. If you've got those factors alone, food is a problem for you to ensure that you can get food on your family's table.
So obviously we seem to be coming out of an economic downturn. Did you see a huge increase in the number of people who were needing help during that downturn? And has that started to reverse itself? Cindy, you mentioned that you just had a record day. So
right. No, as a matter of fact, we were talking earlier about the fact we're almost recession counterintuitive. You would think that as we all are hopeful that we're coming out of this recession, no, the numbers, we've doubled in the last, since the start of the Great Recession, and there's no end in sight. We're finding more and more people are falling into that category of the working poor that just can't make ends meet. So to Clark's point, it's an issue for our whole community in Central Indiana that, no, unfortunately, it's not going away.
Do you think that's because as the unemployment rate has dropped somewhat, people just are not making as much money as they used to, or is it that costs are going up? What's the problem?
Well, it's interesting because unemployment has not dropped that much. It ticks a little bit up and down. But really what affects hunger is the combination of unemployment and poverty. And both of those numbers are not going in favorable ways. And so more and more people are hungry. They don't have enough to make ends meet. So they're actually having to cut. They have to have a roof over their heads. They have to get someplace for a job or jobs. And so food is the last thing that suffers.
And so, and just to add to Cindy's comments, Mark Bittman had a column last week, and he talked about the substantial number of people who were unemployed, out of jobs, say paying $12 to $15 an hour, and are now back employed, but making just above minimum wage. And when you're just above minimum wage, you cannot make it.
You talked about the, did you want to add something, Clark? You talked about the importance of the community and knowledge in the community. What would you like to see those folks who live in Central Indiana and across the state do about this problem? If they become aware, what's the best thing they can do to help?
Visit a organization that's doing very good positive things about food and hunger in Central Indiana. So we can all read the headlines and try to be informed, but actually step foot into the community and see it face to face. The one positive aspect that we see in the work we do and the opportunities that we do working together with the other organizations that are here, people from all walks of life come together around food. So if you can put the judgments aside or the politics aside, and we see that when Congressman Carson visited our dinner meal program, a successful collaboration with Second Helpings providing the food, volunteers from IPL or Eli Lilly and Company or St. Christopher's Church, for example, serving the food, hosting the food and the meal, and youth coming from all walks of life as well. So people from all walks of life converge on to simply provide food and solve one of the challenges that we have in the community. So community is an important part of the
work. Again, I'd like to amplify that. One of the other things I do is something called the Interfaith Hunger Initiative, and one of the things I've learned from that is that all the different faith traditions call their adherents to respond to the hungry. So whether you're on a variety of ways, whether it's economic, faith lines, it's a great thing to bring people together.
The other thing that I think, to Clark's point, too, is we were talking about it just the other day. It's great to come one day, you know, in Thanksgiving time to want to feed people. But we need people 365 days a year. We need volunteers. They're going to volunteer their time on a regular basis, because every day we need them. So that's the most important thing, too, is for people to get engaged, but not just once a year, come in and help us on a regular basis.
I think a lot of people are not quite sure what is the best use of their resources. Is it volunteering? Is it money? Is it actually bringing you food?
All of those things. You know, you can't do it without any one of those things. We all have budgets that we have to meet, so we certainly want the resources, but we love the time and the talent, whether it be a special project that we need doing and we need a particular expertise to help us with something, or it's just working side by side with serving people. So it's all three of those things. It's the time, the talent, and the treasure.
How much of a time commitment would it be for folks to volunteer for one of your groups?
Well, we have hours that we ask for a shift of 3 to 4 hours. We can do that. We can do it on a Thursday evening. We can do it on a Saturday or any day of the week.
Yeah, I think any organization that you're going to see in the area will be flexible. It's got to be a meaningful opportunity for the volunteer or the donor. And different organizations are providing different hours and services.
In the India Hunger Network, we have some people professionally engaged, so as we do our systems work, but then we strongly encourage people to volunteer with cleaners and second helpings and Meals on Wheels and SECOA and all of our partners.
I'm going to put a call out, too, because what we struggle with is that, for instance, St. Vincent de Paul is one of the largest food pantries in the region. It needs younger volunteers. They have just a cadre of folks in their mid-70s that are getting up there in age. We need younger, regular volunteers.
We're talking about hunger and summer food programs. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, sitting in today for John Kroll. We are talking about hunger and summer food programs with our guests, Cindy Hubert, the president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Dave Miner with the Indy Hunger Network, and Clark Linneman, the executive director of the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center. Of course, one of the biggest government programs that aims to help people who are poor is the food stamp program, which is now known as SNAP. Could you talk a little bit, Cindy, about the importance of the SNAP program in fighting poverty?
Well, it's not just fighting poverty, it's fighting hunger. But yes, most importantly, the SNAP program really provides those that are in need the ability to, it's a supplemental nutrition assistance program, and that's exactly what it is. It cannot provide all of the needs for a poverty or poor family, but it does supplement their income to make sure that they can get enough food. It will not last a whole month. But it does at least relieve some of the pressure on the charitable organizations to provide food. So it's very important for our system to ensure that we do have the SNAP benefits.
Clark, can you talk a little bit about your organization, and do most of the people who come to the Mary Rigg Center have SNAP benefits, or a lot of them not qualify for it?
Probably over 75% of the people, I would guess, that are coming to the center. We also are very involved at 4 public schools. So certainly from the school-based point of view, SNAP is essential, providing the funding for breakfast and lunch, free and reduced lunch programs, that when school is in session, SNAP is a huge part.
The federal government spends, I think, about $80 billion a year on the SNAP program, and it serves 47 million Americans nationwide. But Republicans in the U.S. House are considering some cuts. Dave, can you talk a little bit about what those cuts might mean for the Hoosiers who now use the program?
Sure. But first, we have to give you a little bit of background. When the network first came together, one of the first things we did was look at who's providing what, both in terms of quantity and in terms of type of support. And I think it's safe to say, Cindy, that every one of us was astounded by the data. And we've repeated the analysis multiple times now. Over 90% of the food that goes to people who need assistance is federal. Over 90. When you take all of the fabulous organizations, all the pantries at the local level, like Mary Rigg and Gleaners and Second Helpings, all of the private sources together add up to less than 10%.
That is a surprising number. I would never have guessed that.
And we've shown that data to lots and lots of people, and everybody's like, oh, my gosh, I had no idea. And as soon as you, of course, look at that, you go, no, wait a minute. I need to pay attention to these public programs as well as the private programs. And then it gets more interesting because most of the public programs is SNAP. Of the whole pie of food assistance, SNAP by itself is 2/3. So, again, everything else, all the private programs, school meals, WIC, all everything else is 1/3. So if you want to end hunger, you can't ignore the 2/3. And as Cindy said, if you cut that, then a small cut in SNAP is equivalent to all of the output of the private programs together. It's a funny system in a sense that we have set up. All the programs are designed to be partial solutions. Nobody solves the whole thing. If you're on SNAP and you qualify, that'll cover you for 3 weeks out of the month, as Cindy said. But your kids better be enrolled at school, and you better be finding a summer serving site. You better be using the food pantry at Mary Rigg. Only when you start to put all of the sources together can you support your family.
Do you think the public is very well aware of the potential cuts that could take place in the federal SNAP program?
I think because of the information we just talked about is not that well understood, I think most people don't really realize what's being discussed. There's a quite understandable reaction to the size of the program, but the program has gone up in the last years because poverty went up because the recession happened, right? So over time, over the last 30 or 40 years, the program has gone up and down to match the unemployment rate. That's the way it was designed. So the best anti-hunger program we could have is a truly improving economy that helped everybody across the economic spectrum. So no, I don't think people realize that when you talk about a $20 billion cut, what the impact of that would be in terms of people right where you live. About almost half of the recipients of SNAP are children. Mm-hmm. So I know that this is not what they're trying to do, but you are literally taking food out of the mouths of children if Congress goes through with some of those cuts.
The other thing I think, Leslie, is that we hear an awful lot about the fraud in SNAP, and I think it's less than 0.1%. I mean, it's just such a small number, but we tend to focus on that instead of focusing on the good that SNAP does and feeding the children and feeding the families. So I think we have to be very cautious and careful about not just focusing on the negative, but what the positive, what the system does. The other thing that I think it's important for people to understand is there are limits of what you can purchase with a SNAP dollar. So you're not getting alcohol, you're not getting tobacco. In fact, you're not getting toilet paper nor paper towels or diapers. So it's just food, and we have to be very cautious about that.
I'd like to go to a caller. We have Daniel. Daniel, would you like to ask a question of our panel?
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I was just wondering, my brother, he works at IPS, and he sees a lot of kids leaving school because they're growing up in areas of concentrated poverty. So what they see a lot of the times is parents either not working or working at minimum wage jobs like fast food, and they can make more money. The kids can make money if they just quit school and work at fast food, and this kind of perpetuates hunger or food insecurity. And I was wondering, are there any programs within the city that your listeners could participate in to kind of remove these social or the lack of being able to see, you know, hey, this person's going to college. Can this person, maybe I can be like this person.
Daniel, thank you so much for your question. Clark, can you talk a little bit about what kinds of programs are out there to try to help kids that are in these situations?
Well, there's substantial community intervention in community and school-based programs. One program in particular that Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center and 50 other partners are involved with is at George Washington Community High School. So there's a significant community, cross-sector community intervention to try to support not only the students, but the students' parents and their family situation, as well as the community right around that school environment. So those efforts are going across the city. There are still children and students that are choosing to exit traditional education. That's a citywide problem, just like hunger. But there are community efforts that are making a big mark and having success on it. But if a student and family allow their student to walk away from school, that's a tough one for the community to counter.
We at Gleaners have an interesting thing. We, too, found that, Clark, where we felt that we have a BACSAC program, which is geared towards the younger children, but there was really a void for the older children when they got to middle school and high school. So we have a program called the School-Based Pantry, and we actually have a pantry in the school. And what that's encouraged is for the children to stay in school to be fed. It brings the families in to get engaged in with the children because they can access that pantry. And so it's really had remarkable impact that the children stay in school because they don't have to go out to get a low-paying job to feed their families.
Hunger, we've all talked about here, is obviously part of the larger poverty problem. How often do your organizations, and obviously, Clark, at Mary Rigg, you're dealing with lots of different issues, but how often do you all interact with other poverty groups that may not actually have anything to do with hunger in and of itself? Do you mostly focus obviously on hunger? Do you deal with the economic job situation as well?
Well, absolutely. I mean, part of what Clark does is the employment part of it. Second Helpings, which is a part of our Indy Hunger Network, has a job training program that they utilize to prepare underemployed and unemployed folks into culinary food area. So yes, we are always relating with the folks that are looking for more opportunities to get people employed.
One of the things that we're particularly intrigued by in our work so far is the potential to use food to connect people to other support. The most important of which, perhaps, is having people know that if they have a human services need, they should dial 211. We did a little market research and found out that a sad percentage of people know about 211. It's a fabulous service, but it needs to be better known. So we are marketing 211 in the food pantries as a way of, okay, you're here and you're getting emergency food, but by the way, there's a way you can get connected to more support.
If our listeners don't know, can you explain what 211, how that works?
Well, 211, and also that connects people into the whole United Way of Central Indiana services and beyond. So 211 is a one call that an individual can make either on behalf of their own situation or on a friend or neighbor that they know needs to find some additional assistance. 211 would be the number to call.
And literally, you just literally call 211. It's like dialing for emergency, but instead you're dialing 211 for food and other social services. Is that
right?
Correct?
Absolutely. Yes. And the other thing, that it is very much the jewel of our community because there is a live person on that phone 24/7. It's pretty remarkable the kind of support and the help that you can get on 211.
And can you call 211 from a cell phone as well?
Or yes.
So it can be a cell phone or a landline.
Correct. Absolutely.
So I'd like to go to another caller. We have Ben. Ben, what is your question for the panel?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was in grad school for political science, and we did a lot of research on welfare programs, SNAP, WIC, that sort of thing. And we're talking about cuts in the program, that naturally raises questions about public opposition to it. And there's a whole body of research that shows quite disturbingly that these programs have become called race-coded, meaning when people think welfare, when people think SNAP and food assistance, they think essentially not working by choice, usually African-American recipients. And as a result, that's why a lot of people oppose it. And it's very upsetting and very disturbing. So I'm wondering if, one, the panelists could comment on whether they've seen that sort of on the ground, and two, what we might be able to do at a local level to sort of combat that that's been so ingrained in the public consciousness over years and years and years of terrible media choices. So I appreciate taking my call, and I look forward to the response. Thank you.
Well, I think they're all eager here to jump into this one. Clark, do you want to go ahead?
Well, a couple points. One, I think all that research has to be revisited with the great economic meltdown we experienced. So the whole notion of what used to be typically seen as low-income issues, the entire middle-income category was thrust into traditional low-income situations. So coming out of the recession, the lines are really blurry on who is participating in SNAP, where that big increase in SNAP recipients occurred. It is no longer the traditional notions that would have been 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So I would encourage the research to continue. But one other thing, too, when we look at research and statistics and they're talking about cuts, I think there's two important elements. One is that assumes that the programs are currently doing an adequate job, which they're not. And so there'd be other research that the media doesn't pay attention to. They're just talking about in terms of, well, we obviously need to cut these programs. The other element of that is the population is growing. Not only is the overall population growing, but the population that are eligible for these federal programs is growing. So on the one hand, they're not currently meeting the need or doing an adequate job, and you've got a huge increase in the population groups that need this help. This is an opportunity to help them for this part in their chapter in their life, and these programs are not easy to get on or stay on. And then you've got the media and the politics of it is just talking about we assume that we have the ability to make a cut.
Dave, can you talk a little bit about the race issues and the perceptions of people who are on these programs?
Yeah, I think that your caller is really on to something here. I think all of us tend to carry around stereotypes on various things, and I think the stereotypes in case of hunger are wrong. A few years ago, I participated in the Gleaners part of a nationwide study, and I interviewed literally dozens of people at soup kitchens, food pantries, and shelters across central Indiana. And I'm a scientist by training, so I was going in looking for the pattern, you know, and it doesn't fit the pattern. I talk to people with advanced degrees. I talk to people with hadn't finished high school. I talk to people of all races, all ages, all nationalities. It just, the stereotypes are not correct. And so, yeah, it can lead us to do some really unfortunate things. The other thing I would add is I think, like, we should love and care for all of our neighbors. And most of the folks out there are really trying their best. And a few are not, and a few are trying to use the system. But most, you know, they're trying their best.
I agree, Dave. I think what we have to do is funny because as I pulled out of the parking lot at Gleaners, we had a long line. We probably had 50 or 60 people standing in line at the pantry. And I will tell you, it was quite the mix. It was not what we all perceive it to be. We had young, we have old. We're finding an awful lot of grandparents are standing in lines with grandchildren that are now raising. So I think we need to get away from those stereotypes. And, Ben, I would suggest get you and your colleagues to go out and volunteer, and you'll see the face of hunger. And it certainly is different than how we portray it sometimes in the media.
And so, how do you think that perception hurts the larger effort to try to educate folks about this issue?
Sorry, I was backing up, Leslie.
That's okay.
Just
go
one
on
more.
Ahead.
Sorry, one more
no,
thing.
It's fine.
There's this perception that you're on the programs forever. Absolutely not true. Not true. The data on SNAP is that the average person is on the program for 9 months. In Indiana, that average is even lower. People get into trouble. Things, you know, both halves of a couple lose their job. They need the program. They get on the program. It's not easy, as Clark said. Then one of them gets a job. They're not eligible anymore. They're off the program. So this is not a permanent situation. This is a temporary assistance for folks.
I thought you were going to say, to be honest, that folks get on it, it helps them enough to sort of move on and get off. But you're saying that people are off the program, but really still need a lot of help.
Yeah, actually, I mean, we are so careful to make sure that nobody gets this who doesn't deserve it, that as soon as you get a job, you're off the, you know, if it's a good job, you're off the program. And sometimes people are not quite ready for that. But, you know, we're being pretty careful to limit this to those folks that are most desperate.
So one of the things that the House Republicans have talked about doing actually is adding more work requirements for the SNAP program, so that more people have to do some amount of work to qualify. How do you think that kind of a change will impact the Hoosiers who are on that program now?
I worry about where they're going to go get the jobs. Do we have the jobs available to do that? I mean, I think it's a lofty goal, but if we don't have the jobs that are paying them enough to get off the program and or to supplement the program, is it successful? So I think we can't just do it in an ivory tower. I think we need to figure out, will this really work in real life? I think it's, again, a lofty goal. Whether or not it's a reality, I'm not so sure.
I think, you know, the additional context that we haven't talked about is all the substantial cuts that have already occurred in traditional employment programs or traditional welfare type programs that don't exist anymore. Huge cuts to the IMPACT program and other training programs that they tried to have those strings attached. So you need to be demonstrating that you're doing more on the employment front. I agree with Cindy, but if those jobs aren't out there or readily available for this same group, and the fact that 50% of the families we're talking about have children, that's where SNAP is going to help children. I guess if you had a program that provided medicine that families needed, and you had discussions like, should we attach strings to, they could only get their medicine if the adults in the family could demonstrate whatever arbitrary employment activities you want to come up with in the discussion, I think we would say no, that you need to get the medicine in the hands of the child first, then you can figure out some of this other stuff. Food is right there. It's a basic need. They need food every single day. This is not a negotiation or incentive. We need to provide as a community food to those who need food.
We're talking about hunger and summer food programs. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Leslie Weidenbinder, sitting in for John Kroll. We're talking about hunger and summer food programs with our guests, Cindy Hubert, the president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Dave Miner, the executive director of the Indy Hunger Network, and Clark Linneman, the executive director of the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center. You can join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to go back to something we talked about before the break, about maybe there not being enough food in the system. Dave, can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, we talked about, we had looked at all the different sources and what that comes to when you add that all up. We've also looked at, well, what's the total need? And it's a little difficult to estimate, but the best estimate that we have is we're still about 15 million meals short per year in Marion County of what's needed to meet all the needs. So we still need more people to be engaged. We still need more volunteers. We still need more financial support for organizations that are involved. And we need our federal safety net programs as well, because we're short already. We don't need to add to that gap.
That's actually a difficult concept, I think, for me and probably for some of our listeners to think about, that you're short that many meals. Does that mean there are families that have gone without 15 million meals in a year? How explain that to us a little.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now, you know, you have to divide that by the population of Indianapolis and figure you've got 3 meals a day, 365 days a year. It doesn't make it seem quite so big. The food assistance that's being provided right now is over 200 million meals. So it's not like we're way short, 200, maybe short 15. But that's still, as you say, Leslie, that's a lot of people that are skipping meals, going entire days without eating, parents not eating so that the kids can eat. I mean, sort of all flavors of that.
It's interesting, Leslie, because we had a mobile pantry not too long ago. There was a gentleman in line. He was a Vietnam era veteran and was standing there, and the volunteer gave him his food, and he starts to cry, and he said that he was on a fixed income, his benefits, his VA benefits, but they had just started raising their 4 grandchildren, and he said to the volunteer, the children will be fed first. I mean, if there's a missing meal gap, I mean, there's a problem where all of a sudden they're having to feed people that they don't have the resources to do that.
There is a tremendous emphasis on children that are hungry, and for obvious reasons. But do you think that there is an equally large problem with adults who are hungry?
Oh, absolutely, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. It's an unfortunate group of folks that don't get the attention. We all want to make sure that the children are fed because, of course, they're our future. But yes, it's a growing problem, folks that are falling into poverty that are older.
One thing Cindy said there is important, too. Yeah, a parent or a grandparent can understand and deal with going to bed hungry, but I'll make the choice to make sure my children are fed because they are very important, and parents are doing that. Parents are making those decisions on a daily or weekly basis all across the city. We need to realize that. I think another aspect, not to distract too much, but when we look at childhood hunger, childhood obesity is kind of a counterintuitive problem related to that, perhaps uniquely American, but it's real. So you have children who are going to bed hungry but are also struggling with obesity issues. And I know our community is going to be doing more in the future on childhood obesity, but that oftentimes feeds to a stereotype or a perception
about
the general audience that, well, how bad can our hunger problem be if we're also scoring high on childhood obesity rates? And maybe the network has better answers to explain that to us.
Well, I think the science is that you're getting enough calories, too much calories, but you're not getting nutrition. And those are different, right? You need all the other vitamins and minerals and all those things, and you only need a certain number of calories. There's now a number of studies that show a correlation between obesity and food insecurity in women in particular. And the reasons for that seem to be that if you don't have access to food and then you get access to food, you're going to eat as much as you can because you don't know when your next meal is coming. So that's going to contribute to people overeating. And then cheap calories. If you got a very limited budget, you're going to go for the cheapest calories you can get. And frankly, fresh fruits and vegetables are not cheap calories. And so they're going to get short shrift in your diet.
One of our listeners left a question on Facebook, referencing a column by Erica Smith from the Indianapolis Star last week that had to do with basic cooking programs and helping folks take advantage of community gardens as one way to both help with hunger and nutrition. Are those programs, and we're seeing more of those, do you think those will be helpful?
They'll be very helpful. I think that on a bigger scale, what we need to do is the community gardens are going to be great just for what they are. They're a community garden. They're for a neighborhood. They're for a group of families. They're not going to solve the bigger problem, but they're certainly going to be a part of the local solution, if you will. To get back a little bit to the nutrition, those gardens will provide the nutrition. We at Gleaners know, working with Indy Hunger Network and our partners like Clark, at Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center, we need to be providing nutritional food. It used to be that whatever we gave out, whether it be, you know, cookies, crackers, whatever, we're now very much focused on that. And back to Erica's column, it's very interesting in that we're now making sure in the pantries that they have nutritional information. They have a picture of an artichoke. And then if we have artichokes that we're distributing through the pantries, then we'll tell them what to do with it. So we have an awful lot to do, not only to provide the nutritional food, but then to teach people how to eat it and how to cook it.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, Cindy, was that that Gleaners is actually spending money now to buy more nutritional food. Is that because that's just not what folks tend to donate, or is it a more concerted effort to just get the right foods into the pantry?
It's a combination of both. It's very difficult sometimes to get the fresh fruits and vegetables donated, but it's also to get the right kinds of food. And if we're purchasing it, quite frankly, we have purchasing power, so we can bring it in and make sure that we have it in the quantities and the volume that needs to get out there.
The way our agricultural economy is set up in Indiana, you know, we grow a lot of corn and soybeans, and So you don't have that much locally grown fruits and vegetables. There's some, certainly. Through the Indy Hunger Network and working with a new group, the Food Policy Council, we have taken a look at all the sources of fresh fruits and vegetables, and we looked at gardening and gleaning and growing. And as Cindy said, all those things are good contributors, but the flat-out big volume is Cindy, Gleaners, or Midwest, to go out and buy it by the truckload. Mm-hmm. That's what's providing the biggest, by far, quantity. It's like our conversation about federal and private programs. The purchase is where the big action is in terms of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Two points to follow up on that. Garden on the Go is an innovative local program that's taking fresh fruits and vegetables to community-based sites. Mary Rigg has probably 1 or 2 hours each week where Garden on the Go truck pulls up and provides sells at good prices fresh fruits and vegetables. I think community gardening also brings out there's a lot of formal and informal programs that exist in the community. So, for example, a church, St. Christopher's Church up in Carmel, dropping off this week the fruits, no pun intended, of their community garden effort brought to the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center table to then be shared and used in our meals and food programs is a wonderful example of that community partnership.
We do have a question from a listener on Facebook about how you all feel about the government making stricter rules about what foods can be purchased with government assistance. This listener says that they see children who are not accompanied by their parents in their neighborhood purchasing sugary drinks and candy bars at the gas station with a Hoosier Works card. We talked about the fact that there are a lot of different examples out there of folks doing things, but what do you think about the restrictions that are on the SNAP program right now and what might be a good idea for the future?
That's a tough one because I, for one, don't want somebody telling me that I can't buy ice cream if I want to buy ice cream. So I think we walk a fine line. I do agree that sometimes the sugary drinks are problematic, but I think that I don't want the government to dictate what I'm going to eat, so why do we do that to the poor folks? So I think we have to be very, very careful. I do disagree with the fact that with SNAP you can't buy any paper products, you can't buy toilet paper, you can't buy diapers. I think those are critical parts of a poor person's life. But to tell somebody that they can't buy a candy bar or not, I have a problem with that, I must confess.
And you just can't make a judgment on that one, make a judgment that that's how they always use their benefits, or that family just came back from chronic medical situation at Riley Hospital or something, and they say, you know what, we're going to get a soft drink. You just can't make those judgments. There's isolated abuse situations. No system is perfect. But, I mean, it's a valid point, but you can't control to the full degree how a adult is going to make a buying purchase decision when it's food related.
I think education really is the big lever here. If we could do a lot more in terms of nutrition education, cooking classes, really help people understand, how the choices that they make are going to impact their health.
Could you tell us a little bit about, maybe at Gleaners in particular, about how restaurants and corporate partners contribute food or are there ways to recycle food left over from some of these places?
Well, we at Gleaners don't do that, but certainly Second Helpings does that, where they would take the food from a restaurant that's not used or the convention center. They're well equipped to take that food and reprocess it into meals that are then delivered to Mary Rigg to be served. So
and hundreds of other locations
correct.
Throughout Central Indiana.
So it's there ready to go. Now, we'll get calls. We got a call over the weekend from a truck driver from General Mills that was doing stuff with the Speedway with the race. And so we can arrange to get that food into the system. So it's complex. But if it's a restaurant or an individual, it probably should go to a Second Helpings versus a Gleaners.
And you've highlighted one of the great parts of the private programs, which is they're collecting food that might go to waste. Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful thing.
Do you have a lot of corporate partners that are involved?
We do, yes. As I said, we have all the major retail store, grocery stores. But on top of that, we all have them from a volunteer level, Lilly. We have Cummins. We have FedEx. All of the big players tend to volunteer and get involved with our organization.
And do they contribute financially as well as make their employees available for volunteering?
Yeah. In fact, we have the space, as and I know Mary Rigg does as well, where we can have volunteer groups come in, and so they can get engaged and they can see it face-to-face, and so then they want to come back and get involved.
And one of the great models is when it's a much broader commitment on the part of the company than just we write you a check and we have a little photo op and I'm sure that Clark has those examples. I know Cindy's got those. We have a couple with the Indy Hunger Network, and yes, they're providing financial support, but they're encouraging their employees to volunteer. They're participating in events. It's a real commitment and on the part of the corporation and its employees, not just a we write you a check.
Well, and there's a huge local community corporate support for this through the United Way of Central Indiana campaign, both from a volunteer standpoint as well as financial commitment. When companies are supporting the safety net, food is an important part of that. And part of the safety net is it's never just food. It's never any one thing. So it's you've heard in this conversation today, it's a multitude of factors that are at play in this family. If somebody is really struggling with food, it's not just food. So that whole safety net, United Way of Central Indiana social safety net, is a critical piece that the local corporate scene does an outstanding job to support.
Sean, who is a listener, tweeted a question. Do you all have any ideas for projects that a group could do if they wanted to do something big to try to fight hunger?
I looked at Dave because we all know that in our community there's going to be Indy Do Day where people are going to get involved and volunteer throughout our community on several days in October. So, yes, anybody can come and get involved in those issues. We'll have volunteers in all of our organizations to get involved in the hunger.
What is Indy Do Day?
I think many of us are familiar with Lilly's Day of Caring, Day of Service, and there's a movement to broaden that out much beyond the Lilly Company, and they're calling it Indy Do Day. As Cindy mentioned, it's 2 or 3 days, I think, in October, and they're encouraging a wide variety of organizations to participate. So,
and
many good projects, hunger being some
sure.
of them. Yeah.
Clark, what about at an organization, at a neighborhood center like yours? What could a group do to participate?
Well, some great examples were companies would adopt a certain night, for example, in the meal program. So they'll take ownership of that sometimes for the whole year, sometimes for 3 months. It really is open to what the organization is looking for. We have teams of students, teams of college students, teams of church groups that will come in and host that meal. So providing the hospitality, serving the food, cleaning up, interacting with the youth and the seniors that enjoy that meal, that's a wonderful volunteer opportunity to get involved. And many organizations would have similar opportunities across the city.
Dave, can you talk a little bit? You mentioned that you're with the Interfaith Hunger Group as well. Can you talk about the importance of churches in trying to fight this problem?
Sure. And Cindy could talk really well about this one as well. Most of the couple hundred food pantries in Indianapolis are church-based. So the churches play a huge role, and it varies all over the map in terms of what they do. Sometimes they're hosting it in their own facility. Sometimes they're helping out, like St. Christopher's coming down to Mary Rigg. But the faith community is central to many people's work, and it's a really important part of it. The other, to echo something I said earlier, too, I love the fact that it brings us together. You know, we've had events. We had an event in the chute area of Gleaners Food Bank a couple of years on the 10th anniversary of September 11th. And we had Jewish, Christian, Muslim, secular folks together to pray and to work at Gleaners on behalf of the hungry. It was just spectacular. I love the fact that responding to hunger can bring us together.
One other coming together group opportunity to answer the caller's question. You can pack food bags. You don't have to come down into the city or the inner city neighborhood if you don't want to. You can actually assemble on your own company site or church site or school site and define what you want to pack in that meal program. We want to assemble 100 food baskets, for example, that would be distributed through the network that exists. There's all sorts of team opportunities like that that are being used each week.
I think for an organization or a company, it might be a little intimidating because there are so many organizations about knowing where to start if they want to do a project or form a group. What would you suggest in terms of where to start?
Well, United Way does have a volunteer central where they can actually, people can go in and indicate their interest and then be assigned a place out. Or if they know of an organization, call. Most of us have volunteer coordinators or folks that will help direct them and to identify an activity that might match up with their group or their constituent that they want to volunteer. We do at Gleaners, and I know that Clark does too, as well as Indy Hunger Network.
Yeah, and I think Cindy hit on it. If you can get the match between sort of who you are or what kind of business you're in and what you're trying to do, those are the really powerful ones.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We've been talking today about hunger and food needs. Our guests have been Cindy Hubert, the president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Dave Miner with the Inner Indy Hunger Network. Thank you for being here, Dave.
My pleasure.
And Clark Linneman, the executive director of the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center. Thank you so much, Clark.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks to all of you for joining us. You can join us on Thursday when No Limits will be talking about organ donation. Thanks for being here.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.